Francesca present Seven Matrimony.
Hello, Cinematrimony fans. I am Matt Scalise. And I am... Should I say fan?
No, listeners.
Hello, people that know us, that listen to this, out of pity. Joining me is Francesca. And we're going to talk about The Great Gatsby, which we saw in 3D, as Baz Luhrmann intended it. And so we always sort of seem to lead off with this, but first off, are you glad we saw it in 3D?
No, why do we keep getting suckered into spending $1 million to go?
I know. I thought it would really be worth it to see this in 3D, and I really don't think it was.
I mean,
the number of movies that I feel like were worth it to see in 3D is incredible. I could count them on one hand, probably.
Yeah, I mean...
And actually, I could probably count them on one finger, and it's Coraline. That's about it.
Basically. I would add Avatar to that, just because without the 3D...
It would have been already... completely unbearable without 3D.
Yeah. And as it was not great. But we're not here to talk about that. But... And it was. It's just sort of... It seems like this is what happens with most of them, is they, like, come out the gate kind of swinging, like, his opening was sort of, like... neat and 3D-ish, and then just kind of like the rest of the movie, it's like, well, I'm just watching a 2D movie with stupid glasses on my face.
You're just talking about 3D-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Otherwise, I actually really liked it.
I liked it, too. I think that it feels sort of emotionally muted a little bit. Like, it never really, like, is... tugging at my heartstrings or anything.
But do not agree.
I thought that it was really... I enjoyed watching it, and mostly because I thought it was really well made and has interesting people in it. Can you remind me who the actor is that plays Tom?
I can, and I can do this because his name is Jason Clark, which is the name
what have
of
we seen?
An old friend of mine.
All right,
well. And also a possible listener, Sarah Clark's brother. I think Sarah listens sometimes.
What have we seen actor Jason Clark in? You and
I say he was in Catherine Bigelow something.
Was he in the Australian crime lord movie with
Jackie Weaver? Sorry.
What was that movie called?
The characters' names.
No,
Jason Clark is oh, I'm so ashamed. Everyone's going to be like, you big dumb idiot.
It's okay. You caught it during the podcast.
I know, but I'm still ashamed because
anyways,
for like 30
Tom
seconds
is,
people were like, what's wrong with him?
Tom is Daisy's husband.
He was in Animal Kingdom.
Animal Kingdom. So he was in that. Okay.
So I'm thinking of Jason Clark as the husband of the mistress. What was his character's name?
I don't know. That big Galoot.
Yeah.
So anyways.
Sorry, everyone.
I'm surprised you know that actor's name.
Well, like I said, I know his name because it's the name of an old friend of mine.
All right, well, whatever. But so anyways.
But I was expecting not to like the story very much because when I read it as a 15-year-old, I was just like, blah, these people are gross and they don't do anything. And I think it's a testament to the actors that... these lines, which when I read them in a supposed great classic, I mean, I get it. I understand why it's classic, but like, I didn't feel anything for these characters when I read the book, and I think it was acted in such a way that I did feel for Gatsby and
Daisy, brought them to life.
They were
yeah.
still like selfish and self-centered. Like, they actually imbued some of these, you know, very frivolous people with like inner lives that, you know, I mean, I. Love Carey Mulligan. I think she's just phenomenal. And she made you, like, kind of feel for Daisy, even though Daisy's awful.
But
like,
you know what? The one part, I remember very specifically however old you are when you read this book.
Well, I think I read it my sophomore year.
I don't remember. I don't remember exactly. But I remember when we read the book that there's a line in there where she says, I'm crying because they're such beautiful shirts. And I remember, like, everyone in my class, like, sort of laughing at that and going, this is so stupid. And not really getting it. And when you watch that, when that line happens in this movie, you totally get it. And it makes sense in the context of the moment. Now, some of that is probably because we're a lot older and we're not dumb high school people anymore. But also, I do think that acting-wise, they pulled a lot of stuff off. And I think that the screenplay really did a good job of boiling down this book into just being about the characters and their motives for doing all the things that they do. Because there actually is quite a bit of talking that has to go on before the action at the climax of the movie happens, and so that it will mean anything and make any sense. And they pull off the talking scenes. Like, really, there's a really long scene in the big hot hotel room. Mm-hmm. And it was never a boring scene to me. Like, it feels like a lot happens in that scene, even though it's all just talking.
Yeah, well, I think Leonardo DiCaprio really pulled off something, because I don't remember ever having, like, any feelings of anything towards Gatsby as a character.
Yeah, well, Robert...
He really makes it,
dead,
like,
behind the eyes, Robert Redford plays him in the older filmed version of this movie.
Yeah, and I think Leonardo DiCaprio brought a very, like...
Innocence
and, like, desperation, and, like, it was... You actually really felt bad for this guy who'd spent his whole life posturing, and you, like, really were, like... Oh man, he's doing it all for this girl, and it was basically like an unrequited love story, which I don't really know that, and maybe that's in the book. I'm sorry, everyone who's shaking their fist at their podcast
in the book,
right now.
But
like, I didn't get that at all, and like, I really think like his character made me, like, I felt really bad for him.
Well, I've
and,
made
like, he was so pathetic, and like, I never got that.
I've probably said this on three podcasts that we've done on Cinematrimony, but I'll say it again, that I think that Leonardo DiCaprio is the best working actor today. I think he's the best of his generation. And he doesn't get as much to work with in this movie as he has in his last three movies. But he still, like you said, this is sort of a subtle performance for him. And he makes this character very sympathetic, even though he's not a good guy, and he's very selfish and kind of dumb, but...
not knowing how... I don't really know the book very well. I don't know how much...
We're not talking about the book at all.
I know, but I'm saying, like, I don't know how much of that was Baz Luhrmann really making that the point of it, that, like... Because he said it so many times, like... And I think that it was reiterated by the narrator. What's his name? I don't even remember.
Nick is the narrator.
Oh, yeah, Nick.
Who, I mean, whatever. Tobey Maguire.
Well,
it's
a passive character. He's just supposed to be the observer.
He's as good as anybody for that role, because Tobey Maguire is nothing. So it's fine.
Well, I think that's a little harsh. But anyways, you know, it gets said over and over again that, you know, that it was all for her. He did all of this for her. And they say that multiple times in the movie.
Right.
Like, I mean, just on the nose, say, like, he did all this for her. The house was for her.
A lot of
it's
on the nose.
So I don't know if that was, like, you know, I mean, Baz Luhrmann, I did have a moment where I was like, this is kind of very Moulin Rouge-y, isn't it? Like, not just, obviously, I mean, he has his style of making movies, but, like, in terms of the actual storyline, and that kind of made me go, like, well, is that Baz Luhrmann's imbuing it more with just making it, like, this kind of tragic love story? Like, is that the point of view he's taking? Because that's really... You know, in terms of, I mean, I think part of why you study at school is that it's supposed to, you know, encompass this certain attitude of this era. And that was kind of...
The ennui.
All in service of this love story is what he was telling you.
Yeah.
Which I feel like, you know, 15-year-old me would have liked the book a lot more if that was the main gist of it.
Well, I mean, I do think that that is a Baz Luhrmann characteristic, to not be very clever or subtle about the story and the characters and make it very out in the open and obvious. And that's fine, because it worked, because he's a broad filmmaker, and so it works. I think that probably where this movie loses some of its steam is when it's so heavily focused on that stuff as opposed to the spectacle, because that's when this movie soars for me, and especially the big Gatsby entrance scene, which is the second greatest, it's the second greatest movie scene ever set to Rhapsody in Blue.
Okay.
But it's heavily, and I, by the way, I have to think that it's also, if not influenced by, it is outright referencing Manhattan by having fireworks going off during that bit.
Yeah, no one ever thought of the quintessentially American fireworks being paired with the quintessentially American song, Matt.
What?
I don't think.
Who else has done it? Is there a lot of other people that have done fireworks with Rhapsody in Blue?
Yeah, I think, like, they do that at the Capitol every year.
I think they do
every 4th of July.
Well, if they do, then I apologize for drawing such a connection.
But, all right, so, see, I have to disagree
with
you,
though. It's awesome, though. It is really good.
I honestly think that the spectacle is great, but, I mean, I think, I just keep on, you and I sort of had this conversation the other day that I was saying, like, I'm always going to look forward to Baz Luhrmann films, because while it seems the trend is to go more realistic and small and intimate, like, he is there for the spectacle, he is there for the cinematic nature of film. Like, he's using it to be big and to be bold and to be theatrical, which I think is not really in vogue, but he does it in such a way that it's cool. You know, he mashes, you know, modern music with old-timey, whatever. But I kept on drawing the parallels between he and Wes Anderson as them being, like, opposites, but kind of for the same end, that, you know, everything in Wes Anderson movies is, like, small and contained and detailed, and sort of Baz Luhrmann's everything is, like, huge sets, huge visuals, but even, like, the quieter moments, that's still there, such as when we first meet Daisy, and it's all the window, you know, he's got that room with all the big curtains blowing, and it's, like, this beautiful theatrical moment, even though
there's no minimalism
nothing's
in
happening,
Baz Luhrmann.
And it's not even that elaborate of a set. It's just he's made this really beautiful filmic, is that a word?
Or like flowers moment all over the house where it looks like you're outside when they're having their indoor scene. Yeah.
Right. That he, you know, he does everything big and grand, and nobody else does that anymore. Like, it's not in vogue to make movies that, you know, actually should be seen on a big screen because everything is big, and so it's like cheapened on a television screen. So I'm always going to look forward to seeing what he's going to put out there. Like, even though this is not that complex of a story the way he told it necessarily, it's kind of almost like a Greek tragedy, sort of see where it's all going to end up.
Right.
But it's always going to be interesting to watch this, the way he tells a story as opposed to the story he's telling.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I couldn't really even tell you what the main storyline of Australia is anymore.
Oh, well,
but I remember it. I have a visual memory of that movie in my head. Like, when I think about that movie, I'm seeing a bunch of pictures in my head, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think about the characters of the story because I don't remember anything about it. And I don't really remember anything about the ballroom movie either. And there's probably a lot of plot details that I can't remember about Moulin Rouge. They're all movies that you remember the sort of gut feeling you get watching them and the sort of visual palette. Like, I can almost see, like, colors that are heavily used from all of those movies, you know?
Well, and to me, as someone who, you know, for most of the time, story is king for me, it's fun for me, which again, I draw this parallel with Wes Anderson. Like, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think Wes Anderson in general, the whole picture is a little better in his movies because I always really like his story.
Well, I also think he's a better writer.
But I'm just saying, regardless, those are two directors that I'm always going to want to see their films because I'm not going to get it reading a book, you know,
they're
going to give me watching a film by them.
Although, literally, you could get this in a book, but...
Right. I had this moment...
In Romeo and Juliet.
Yes. I had this moment where I was thinking... I was like, is the blue billboard... Are those supposed to be, like, point-blank Tobey Maguire's eyes?
Like, I didn't think about that. It could be.
I mean, I couldn't establish it because by the time I had it, you only saw them one more time. But I was definitely like, you know, I think... Certainly in the film, anyways. That's really... He's just there to be the observer and sort of... our eyes to see it all.
Right.
But now what did you think about the framework that they put the movie in?
It was good because I think here's why they did it. I think that there's some iconic sentences. It's particularly the opening and closing lines of that book are so iconic that, like, you could, to a lot of people, you could just read those sentences and people know what book you're talking about. And so I think they really wanted to use those sentences and they wanted to have a third person narration because that fits a little bit of the noir theme that's going on in this movie and that he draws on a little bit. And so, you know, in this accomplishes both of those goals. You get those two key lines in there, and then film noir is always set in some kind of narrative framework like that. And in this case, it's that Nick ends up in a sanitarium because it was all so horrible, which is not at all part of the book.
Right.
That's an invention to let you hear Nick narrate it from such a remove, and it still makes sense.
Remove? I don't think that's a thing.
Isn't it?
Such a remove?
A remove? Mm. I'm going to go type that in and see if it's grammatically correct, okay. But
well,
I think it is.
I'll tell you what. When the movie started, I was kind of like, oh, I don't know about this, but I really liked the way it wrapped up, which then I was like, okay.
There's a lull,
I like
though. There's a lull at some point.
No. I'm talking about in terms of the framework of the movie. Like, when they first did that he's, like, telling the story to a psychiatrist, I was like, oh, I don't know about this. But then I really liked the way it wrapped up, and big old spoiler alert. I mean, not that people know what happens in the plot, but this is a spoiler for the film. But the way it ended that he, you know, okay, so he has written his novel that he was, you know,
it's like
to write. But that...
It's like The Hobbit, actually.
He titled it Gatsby by Nick Carraway, and
yeah.
Then he wrote in The Great. To me, that was like this kind of moment of like, that was a big piece of the Nick Carraway puzzle, was that he sort of worshipped him. And it
yes.
sort of, it was just little, you know, moment right at the end that sort of told you a whole lot about your narrator suddenly, was that he wasn't just Gatsby to him, he was the great Gatsby.
Right.
That, like, he kind of thought he was this, you know, remarkable man and, you know, admired him. There's probably some undercurrents of, you know, perhaps he loved him, you know.
Oh, you think?
I think so. I think that's one interpretation of it. That
See,
kind
I,
of,
I think that I've always felt... that my, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but I had always sort of assumed that the discussion about this book is that the narrator is Fitzgerald and that a lot of what he's talking about is America and the 20s and how, you know, what happens to Gatsby is sort of supposed to be representative of the sort of death of optimism in America and that's... This book is sort of Fitzgerald mourning how America, what used to be very hopeful, and it was all dances and parties and fun, and it was all basically hollow. And in the end, that's all gone now.
Well,
as he's talking
even,
about it and writing it.
I'm not really even saying like homosexual love, but just, you know, admiration, like wants to be like him, like something about...
I wouldn't say you were invalid, by the way. I'm sure that's a valid reading that other people have talked about.
But I'm also saying, you know, but like, I think, you know, you, like, Nick never really expresses an interest in any of the women around him.
No, or yeah, that's true.
I think that, you know, he's fascinated and, you know, somewhat thrilled by it, the Gatsby that he sees, you know, even as he's going like, this is a lie, like that's not true, there's no way this is true,
right?
Like, something about him is deeply appealing to him. But I mean, maybe if I read the book now as an adult, I won't, but if I did, maybe I would get more out of it. But
no,
you know.
You're going to go read some novel where a bunch of horrible things happen to children, and then you'll just read it in a weekend. Because that's how you roll.
What am I reading right now?
I don't know. Probably a Barbra Streisand biography, right?
That is up next. I am reading an oral history of women in comedy called We Killed.
Nice.
Thank you very much.
Very nice.
But I guess that is sort of morbid. But it's just the title's morbid.
Yeah.
Talking about stand-up comedy.
Oh, you haven't read any books about children being murdered in a long time, man.
Actually, the Dark Tower book that I just read, that was the premise of that one.
You've read more novels about child murder than I ever have read.
You're being gross. You disgust me.
Anyways.
Yeah, because nobody read The Hunger Games. What a weirdo I am for reading that book. Gosh, sicko, you married. How did I ever find that book?
I'm just comparing the fact that you don't want to read a relatively short book like The Great Gatsby.
I know, I think that's actually...
It's very short.
Reflection. I'm pretty sure that's why... By the way, When was the last time you read a book?
Look,
Matt?
I'm
Why
just
are you getting on my case.
We're talking.
I don't want to read
we're talking.
A book that
we're,
I didn't like when I read it before.
We are talking about you here, not
oh,
me.
Oh, right, right.
I don't read anything. So,
anyways,
it's,
I'm pretty sure that's the only reason that like I pretty much spent my whole high school career reading perhaps 20% of the books that were required.
Oh, me too. But that's probably
and
most
Gatsby
of us.
Gatsby was one of the ones that I did read all the way through, and I'm sure it's because it was a slender volume, as it were. Because I'll tell you what,
so you're
Scarlet
saying,
Letter, I did not read that shit. And we watched some exhaustive,
I'm guessing you did
terrible,
not. You did not read Beowulf in its full old English.
I think I sort of tried to. That was garbage.
Did you have to read Grendel?
Oh, no, that's what I'm thinking of. I didn't read Beowulf.
Ugh, Grendel. Grendel. Awful.
Yeah, blah is right.
Oh, you're so clever, dude, that wrote Grendel with all your symbolism.
So annoying.
Horoscopes.
I liked the Shakespeares that we read, although I didn't read all of them. I remember liking Othello a lot. That was a good one because it was very melodramatic.
Yeah, did you see O?
Like recently.
Yeah. We're way off.
Cat.
We're way off track. But
anyway, so, but I think that's why that got the distinction. Yeah, oh, my point was, I did read that one. But The Scarlet Letter, which I did not read, we had to watch some horrible, horrible, like, blow-by-blow PBS, like, 25-part miniseries that was, like, every part of that boring book.
The Scarlet Letter.
I wrote, like, every essay ever was on The Scarlet Letter, which I never read. Honor student.
Yeah.
Woo-hoo!
That was one that they said, like, they're like, really, though, you can't watch the movie of this one because there's, like, Demi Moore naked in
no,
it.
No, not, but that's what I'm saying. We watched some PBS. Like,
yeah, because they can't show you they can't
so
show
boring.
You the dramatic film of it because it's R-rated.
Ugh, it was so bad. high school reading. And I love to read, and that almost made me, like, never want to read again.
Well, so.
Anyways, I really like this, and I would recommend it. I mean, I guess if you don't like Baz Luhrmann movies, you won't like it.
I liked
it. I really like Baz Luhrmann movies, so.
I liked it. I was not, like, you know, blown away or anything. I don't think that this will be. This was a pleasant experience for me, but I mean, I wouldn't have put this as a Best Picture nominee necessarily, you know?
By the way, Isla Fisher at first was a little jarring, but
we didn't talk about
Isla
Fisher.
I thought I was like, yeah, she's doing a pretty good job.
No, she's good.
Floozy.
You know what?
Surprising because she's such a naturally pretty person. To see her tried to make her like kind of ugly. You know,
I like Isla Fisher, and I think that she is in the tradition of Australian actresses who almost exclusively play Americans. She is. Just sort of, you just forget that she's not American.
Well, and don't forget that Tom, I mean, they're all sort of helped by the fact that, you know, it's like affected English. I mean, not.
Yeah, she gets to do the mall accent.
But that, you know, Tom, whatever that actor's name was, you know, I think he did a good job for being an Australian, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And actually,
Australians in general blend in pretty well over here.
I thought he was actually bringing a lot to the table.
I agree. I think he was really good.
He was, you know, that whole scene in the hotel room was really quite compelling, actually, for
a scene
of a bunch of people talking. And it was really very
really
telling
good.
About, like, that was kind of when you went, like, oh, Daisy and Jay are not, this is not going to work out. Because
no.
He kept on saying, like, tell him you didn't love him, tell him.
And
she
obsessive.
Was so pathetic.
Yeah.
And, like, that was it. It was.
That's DiCaprio's one big scream. He gets one good scream in every movie, it seems like.
Is that right?
You know? Yeah, remember I think we've talked about this, but in the Inception, he's got the big scream. In Shutter Island, he's got the big scream.
Well, listen, he's, it was all there from his
they're
Growing
good.
Pains days. He had it.
Yeah, I'll never forget that scene in Growing Pains where he screams.
He was a foster child.
He screams in horror because he found out that Kirk Cameron took his bicycle.
All right. I will say this, too, for, you know, I kind of thought that Leonardo DiCaprio was, like, getting into a, like, character-y face. He was handsome in this movie. I don't
oh
know,
yeah,
the suits.
I
whatever,
thought he
was
looking
was like,
a little bit fat.
Leo,
not fat, but, like, he does seem like he's growing a little rounder
well,
in the face.
Well, I wonder if maybe it's, like, the long hair youthened him up some, because kind of in, you know, his, I mean, he's not middle-aged.
You say that like you're surprised that Leonardo DiCaprio
is
handsome.
Because, you know, like, when, like, back in the Romeo and Juliet days, hello, like, wow. But then, like, when he kind of became, like, an adult actor, I was like, I don't know. I think he's kind of losing some of his handsomeness. But, like, this kind of got him back to, like, his boyish looks. But, again, maybe it was, like, the hair and being in character.
I think some of it was just the... He wasn't snarling this entire movie like he usually does these days. He was, like, a bright-eyed, innocent dude.
Maybe that's what it was. But, like, when he was, like, throwing all his shirts down, I was like, oh, like, there's handsome Romeo and Juliet Leonardo DiCaprio. Oh,
did you get all sad when like, he was well, throwing no,
was
the shirts?
Like, I was like, oh.
Were you crying like, looks- because the shirts were so beautiful, Francesca?
Yes, that's what was happening, Matt. That is exactly what was happening. But... Like I said, again, my hats are off to the performances, and of course the production design was good, and I know that Ben Flanagan will be disappointed to know that there was no, yeah, and me was not in the movie.
Were you bothered by the multiple uses of Jay-Z, or did it work for you?
No, it was fine. I mean, I have no prior knowledge of Jay-Z. He's not really my jam, as it were, so.
What about the scene where they have the jazz singer doing, Crazy in Love.
You know, I have been aware for some time now of the Pupini Sisters' rendition of this.
Oh, they song. Do a version?
Yes. And so I am aware of, I already knew of its potential to
so
be.
So it's been done.
Crazy in Love.
That's been done then.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly the same as that, but they're not breaking new ground there. It does lend itself to being like a little flapper's tune. But no, I mean, that's Baz Luhrmann. So, you know, it is par for the course, and I think he makes it work. It's not... It doesn't take you out of anything.
All right.
But he uses modern music.
So, we'll wrap. We went a little long on this one, but that's good. We got into it. All right. Well, that'll do it for us.
Should we tell the good people?
What?
Yes, we will. So that then you will be held accountable. We are going to put up an iTunes feed of Cinematic
Movies. Oh, yeah. Okay.
And we have now a full... I mean, we've been doing this for like... What, 4 years?
Yeah,
3 years
it may not be fully populated.
No, it's going to be.
No, with the back catalog.
It's going to have the entire back catalog.
They will eventually all be added, eventually.
Nope.
But certainly.
Nope. You're going to do it all.
Certainly a lot of them will be available
Please
by the time you hear this.
Please feel free to harass Matt as much as possible. Because wouldn't you love to listen to this stupid podcast right after you watched, like, Animal Kingdom from 2000 and whatever, 10?
Or Catfish.
Or Catfish. Wouldn't you love to go back and read... Well,
might I recommend Black Swan?
Oh. Maybe not. Don't watch that movie and don't...
But definitely listen to that podcast because that's the best one that we've ever done.
I don't know. That's true. But also, so Matt is definitely going to do that this weekend. And if he doesn't, harass him until he does because he doesn't listen to his wife when she says, why don't we put these things on iTunes?
I
want to listen to you.
I'm fine with
and
that.
Nobody wants to stream stuff off of a website.
Everyone burn. I'm burning the ships behind me to make sure that I do it. Everyone, please harass me if I don't do it.
Also, Matt and I are bandying about the idea of perhaps doing Cinematrimony Classic after our, I would say, inspired Jurassic Park Cinematrimony. So, let us know what you think about that. If we go back and watch movies
if
that
you
we
have
haven't seen before.
If you have suggestions for movies we could do that for, maybe. We could take user suggestions, listener suggestions.
All right, don't be hasty.
All right, well.
I want to listen to what these people...
If you have a suggestion, email matt@filmnerds.com. Or
yeah,
post,
Francesca doesn't have a Film Nerds email.
Or post it on our Facebook page, the Film Nerds Facebook page.
I think that's all the housekeeping.
Okay.
If you like this, tell your friends.
Do it.
Listen. And... tell us that you listen because I have low self-esteem and I'd like to know if people are listening to our podcast.
Yeah, if you listen to this, please acknowledge it somewhere on Facebook for Francesca.
Or with cash money sent to our home address. It's also a way to acknowledge that you listen.
Acceptable.
Yes.
All right, thanks.
All right, bye.